This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is brought to you by Larson & Larson. They are my intellectual property lawyers, and they should be yours. Well, I'm always thrilled to talk to writers, and today is no exception, especially since she is one of the most thrilling mystery writers around, Margaret Maron. I don't know even where to start with Margaret because she's won every award, and if I started listing them, we would be here just for an hour listing all the awards. Hi, Margaret, are you there?
I am, Patsy. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, it is so wonderful to welcome you to Joy on Paper because, well, you have brought so much joy with your series of books to so many readers. And I just had to get you on because I realized, you know, I could not believe when I looked back at it that it was in 1992 that you came out with your first book in the Judge Deborah Knott series. And yes. For me, I'm one of those people who can recall, you know, books I read. I can recall where I read them. I can recall what I was drinking when I read them.
Or what you were supposed to be doing.
I try to forget that now because it's generally the laundry, the dishes, all of those things. So I try to forget those things. But I do remember that. And I remember the first line of your book. Because when I first read, Possum Creek trickles out of a swampy waste a little south of Raleigh. And then it goes on. By the time it gets down to Cotton Grove in the western part of Colleton County, it's a respectable stream, deep enough for flat rafts and canoes. And right there, you've set the tone. And I tell my listeners always in the, when they're, especially the writers, people who are trying to become better writers, that they always have to look at that first page. And if that first page grabs them, that's the sign that you're in for a real treat. And certainly,
I wanted the setting to be almost like a character, character.
Well, of course, we're talking about one of the most popular books, I think. I don't know. It's like, what is it? One of the top 100 books?
Well, that's what one group, the independent mystery booksellers, voted it, yes.
And that's, of course, The Bootlegger's Daughter. And you set the scene so beautifully. And I just want to, this is for the readers out there. On the same first page in that book, she writes, and I'll just say some of the words. The town keeps the banks mowed. Virginia creeper and honeysuckle fight it out in the dooryard with blackberry brambles and poison ivy. Right there, I mean, you've told us so much. And we know what's going to be, what this story is going to encompass.
You definitely know that you're in the South.
You know you're in the South. You know there's something, there's going to be something mysterious going on. It is such a great first page. Well,
thank you.
You know, and it just, of course, set the tone for all of the books that follow. And the latest book, of course,
Long Upon the Land.
Yes, was, I think, number 20, right?
It was.
Wow.
20 and gone.
20 and gone. Wait, I know many of your fans are like, they keep saying, well, she says it's 20 and gone, but there's probably some short stories. There's probably a few little side things she's going to, because you created with Deborah Knott a character with a family. Just talk a little bit about, I mean, it was so clever of you to come out with the idea of creating a judge to be your main character. It was at that time, I'm not sure if there's anybody yet who has one, because that was unique. She wasn't a detective. She wasn't a policewoman. And how did you come up with that idea? Because you had already worked.
Exactly it. You know, I had another series. I had a New York series in which the protagonist, the sleuth, was a homicide detective. So when I wanted to bring my writing south, I decided that she couldn't be a police officer, and it was going to be a female, and she couldn't be a police officer because I already done that. And private detectives, and I didn't want her not to be somehow connected with the court system, because I never had much confidence in my ability to create an amateur sleuth who keeps stumbling over bodies and feels that she must solve the murder. Which is why my first character was a police officer, because I figured I'd just make her a homicide detective.
That's Lieutenant Sigrid Harold of the NYPD.
And I could just write about her most interesting cases. But when I came south, and I knew that I wanted to explore aspects of the state, I thought, and for some reason I thought, nobody's done a judge. And making her a judge, she can sort of poke her nose into a murder mystery, and the police, the sheriff's department, is not going to tell her to butt out, because sheriffs don't tell judges that.
That's for sure.
And because at that time, they don't do it as much now as they did when I first started writing about it, but there's still, judges will get specialed in to a different court in a different part of the state where they don't have any kind of connection and don't have to worry about putting someone's noses out of joint, because the people in that area are not going to ever vote on her. But so whenever there's a case comes up in a different part of the state where the local judges don't want to handle it for whatever political reasons, they will send a special judge in. And so this is how I let Deborah go all over the state and let me look at different aspects of North Carolina that fascinated me.
Well, you've done it so beautifully. As I said, when you describe a scene, a location, it's so beautifully done.
Thank you.
Just amazing. And, of course, to help the whole plot line, the fact that Deborah Knott is the daughter of a infamous bootlegger, and
wasn't that fun? That was so much fun. I thought, what a lovely contrast. Of course, she is the youngest daughter. I mean, the youngest child, and the only daughter. And she has 11 older brothers.
Now, wow,
Patsy, I'm going to tell you something, and you know, maybe we should keep this between ourselves.
Uh-huh.
But if I were doing it over again, I'd only give her 5 brothers. You know, 11 was a little excessive.
Oh, well, I don't know. My father came from a family of he had 11 brothers and sisters. So, you know, that's not unknown.
And so did my grandmother.
You know, I come from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And, of course, there we have a 100-year-old farm.
Uh-huh.
So I could relate very well to to your character. And it's funny how I think it's, we should explain to people, of course, you are from, from the South, from North Carolina, and then you went to New York, and that's where you were living for quite a few years. How many years did you live?
About 10 years. Yeah.
About 10 years. But you lived in Brooklyn, but you don't have a Brooklyn accent, which is...
Well, I'm not from Brooklyn.
Well, I know, but sometimes I had a little bet with my sister. I said, I'm sure she wouldn't pick up that Brooklyn accent, not when she's got this beautiful North Carolina accent.
Oh, yeah.
So I relate to families with 11. You know, we still have, like, we also have, like, a county up in Michigan that belongs to us. So it certainly opens a lot of storylines for you.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And it's an interesting family, because I think your use of the family in your storyline of making them an interesting family. They do things together. How did you build this up?
Living out in the country on a farm, and Kezi Knott, her father, is one of those who, if he ever had any extra money in his jeans, he would buy another acre of land if he could. So they've wound up with a couple of thousand acres, and the whole family, well, not the whole family, but a bunch of them do still live there and farm, and in a sort of a cooperative thing. And they use each other, you know, they borrow tractors and disc plows and things like that.
Oh, I know that. They still do that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll tell you another thing. I did not want to write about a dysfunctional Southern family.
Oh, thank goodness.
People don't like each other, and I didn't want to look down. I wanted to celebrate the people that I grew up with, and I didn't want to trash them, and I didn't want, you know, it's very, I count it as a badge of honor that I have never let a single one of my characters go to a Piggly Wiggly store.
Well, you know, that was, you know, from coming from, as I said, from Northern Michigan, I was never intrigued. I read, you know, Southern stories from, you know, great, you know, famous Southern stories.
Sure.
But
yeah.
But there was always that I didn't like to know about this, some of these families. And
yeah.
That's why I think your books are so relatable to people, because you do have this nice family.
They like each other. I mean, they squabble like all.
Well, sure. Who doesn't?
but they are mutually supportive.
Exactly.
And mutually attentive, and they like each other. And that's what I wanted to celebrate. That's what I wanted to show, that they didn't have to be dysfunctional, and they didn't have to have a crazy aunt in the attic, or a perverted personality.
Yeah, exactly. That's, I think, well, that is one of the things that make your books so much fun to read.
Well, they're not saints. I mean, she's
no.
Some of the brothers have seen the inside of a jail cell.
Best of families.
Exactly. But they're basically good people, is what I wanted to show.
They do, and they do work sort of for the common good, I think it's a great family. And of course, I have to tell people that who will read your books, they have to go to your website, because there you have the family tree.
Yes.
Which
people felt like they needed that family tree.
Which helps.
But you know what's so interesting about that family tree? When I created it, I gave her a niece that was older than she was. She was, because she's at the tail end, and I gave the older brother a daughter who had fallen off the family tree and was out of the picture. Nobody knew where the child was or where she grew up. And then when I came to write a later book and I needed to have a long-lost relative, I went looking, and there she was. She was under a different name, going by a different nickname. But there she was. I had created her like 4 or 5 books before I needed her.
Well, I'm wondering, how do you keep track of everybody? Are you one of those, obviously, you must be very organized with all of this complicated fan.
I am pretty organized, yeah. Pat. See, what I do is I have a running list. I call it my Bible. And every time I create a new character, I enter it twice, once by the surname and once by the given name. And that way I can keep and where they first appeared. And if I gave them blue eyes or, you know, red hair, or if they drove a Cadillac, or if they drove a Jeep, I put the things that I know that I might want to refer to again, and I keep it in this in my Bible, as I call it. If I were to print it out, it would come to something like 42 pages, single spaced.
Well, it's going to go in with your archives, and researchers 100 years from now will be reading that to write very, very. Very intellectual papers on the Southern family based on your books.
Oh, wouldn't that be a hoot?
Well, it's going to happen, because as I said, with Bootlegger's Daughter, which came out in 1992, which I still can't believe because it is so fresh in my mind. And
another thing that I do, you know, if anybody is bothered by chronology, I mean, when it came out in 1992, she was 34 years old.
Uh-huh.
And the book last year, she's approaching 40. Now, truly, time has not stood still. But I write, when I'm writing, instead of trying to go back and make it all consistent with the early 90s, I write in what I call the current now. I may make references to cell phones. And, you know, in 1992, everybody had a landline that was connected by a cord to the wall. And in 2015, everybody's got a cell phone. Even the brothers who are out on a tractor have a cell phone. So I keep it current that way. But there are people who will occasionally say, hey, wait a minute, Kezzy Knott's got to be 110 now.
But, well, that's what you can do when you create your own universe, right?
Exactly.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is. I didn't, you know, Sue Grafton, and who I admire tremendously, she started her books with Kenzie Milhone in the 80s, I guess, late 80s. And she's kept her there, which means that Kenzie doesn't have access to the Internet and she can't Google somebody. And so now they're almost like period pieces, which I admire very much, but I thought, I just can't do that. I can't do that. I'm going to keep her up to date.
And you have to do your research if you're going to keep it in that period.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, Carolyn Hart was on my program on Tuesday.
Oh,
and
okay.
And so, and of course, you know her.
Oh, yeah, she's
and,
a good friend.
And with her Annie Darling. I'm not sure that Annie Darling also hasn't aged significantly. So,
right.
Because if she did, then Lorelai, her mother-in-law, would be also 100.
Yes, yes.
And we would.
Lorelai is so much fun, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah. Oh, she is, and
you
she
know
is.
Who, I have to recommend somebody to you if you're not familiar with this work. Do you know Doug Allen?
No.
Doug Allen mostly writes short stories. I think he has written some, but he's from the Upper Peninsula.
Ah!
And he writes about the Woodsmoke boys, and he's won Edgar's for his short stories. You know, if you're from that area, you might want to look into his work and have him on. I think he's a wonderful short story writer.
Okay. Well, I've been looking for short story writers because I think it's a wonderful opportunity for writers to sort of dip their toe in and
exactly.
And work on it. And I know you had a short story recently, didn't you? Have in where did you have a short story?
I had a short story in the last issue of Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine.
That's right. Yes,
the pack. Yeah.
And so that's that. As I said, it's a great way to dip your toe in. I mean, when you started writing, did you write short stories first?
Yes, I wrote short story. You know, a lot of writers have, you know, two or three novels in their file drawers that didn't sell. I never wasted my time writing bad novels. I wrote bad short stories. So I have about five or six short stories that didn't sell. But talking about short stories, that's where Deborah first originated. She was first a short story, Deborah's Judgment. Sarah Paretsky was putting together an anthology of women writers and with women protagonists and called A Woman's Eye. And she invited me to be in that anthology. And I had never really written, my books were third person. And I thought, you know, let's see what a first person would feel like. And Deborah not just sort of strolled into my mind and started talking and wouldn't shut up. And that was the first incarnation. She was a short story for Sarah Paretsky first.
Wow. And yeah, it is. It's changed when you go from third person to first person.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In a way, it's good because you don't have to say, you know, you don't have to describe a whole lot. It's like when you walk into your kitchen, you don't say, oh, look at the clock on the wall, and my stove is a gas stove, not an electric stove. You just take that for granted. And so when you're writing first person, you can take a whole lot for granted. Now, this is not to say you don't need a lot of description. And another thing that I forget where I read it, but years and years ago, I read some writer, I think he was a science fiction writer, and I'm not sure which one he was, because I read a lot of science fiction in those days. But he said, put an appeal to the senses on every page, other than sight. You know, what is the character smelling? What is the character touching? What can the character hear? If you put, you know, it's not enough to show what the character sees. If you really want that character to be well-rounded, you have to give them the other senses, too.
And you certainly do that. Wow.
I try to.
Well, you do. And actually, I've also noticed that in when writing in first person, the audible books seem to flow much nicer, too, with the first person.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things that helps me with the audible books, I read them out loud. My husband is my sounding board. He's the only one that sees it before the agent and the editor do. And he doesn't see it. He has to hear it, because if I give him the manuscript, he'll mark it up. So I finish a chapter, and we'll have lunch together, and I'll read him the chapter. And if it doesn't read smoothly, if I can't tell where the pauses are to take a breath, I will change it.
Well, that is a great suggestion for all the writers out there. I think a lot of people don't do that, and that's exactly right, that if you can read it and it sounds smooth and it makes sense and the other person doesn't say, what does it mean? What does that mean? Why is it? Why? Then,
and you get the idioms, and you do get the flow of the conversation that way. And he'll say to me, would Deborah really say that? I mean, he gives me his critiques, but without a red pencil in his hand.
Yeah. Yeah, because that sometimes does get to you when you see too many red pencils. So, that is a very, very good idea for people to think about, to mm-hmm. read it out loud before they show it to anybody and before they...
It'll let you know whether or not it's stilted, whether the conversation is stilted, or whether or not that's what someone would say.
And even if you don't have somebody to read it to, you read it and record it. Nowadays, you can have these on your computer. You can have your you know, program that you can just, like Dragon, you can read it in and listen back to it.
Exactly.
Now, when you started thinking about computers and everything else, when you did Bootlegger's Daughter, that was back in, as I said, so I can't believe it. I still can't believe it. That when I can see a book, I have that ability. I can close my eyes sometimes, and I can see the page that I've read like 30 years ago. And I will know if it was on the left side or the right side. I will know if it's the second paragraph or the third paragraph. You know, so I have this crazy ability to do this. And so when I was thinking of Bootlegger's Daughter, and I realized that, my goodness, I know this first. I know the first line. And probably I was drinking. I was probably, because I always drink whatever I'm, like if I'm reading an English book, I'm probably drinking hot tea. And
please don't say you were drinking homemade brew.
Well, no, I was going to say, I didn't have any homemade brew. I think I was drinking iced tea. And otherwise, I'm drinking coffee. Now, if I read Raymond Chandler, I probably need a whiskey. So, you know, it can get a little dangerous in there. Actually, I read Amor Toil's book. Did you read it, The Gentleman in Moscow, yet?
No, I haven't read that yet.
You have to read it, because there you just want to sit there with a bottle of champagne and drink champagne for the whole book. I mean, I'm reading that book at 5 in the morning, and I'm saying, I need some champagne here. So, yeah, I didn't have any bootleg whiskey, but I don't know. Have you indulged in that?
At Christmas time. I mean, you know, you have to have a little bit for the eggnog and everything. But I was doing a program out in the western part of the state, and when I got to my motel room that they had arranged for me, there was it was in the fall, and there was a big bowl of apples, and in the middle was a wine bottle, it was Matus rosé wine, but it had been opened. And I thought, well, that's odd for them to open the wine before. So I pulled the plug on it, and I poured a glass, and it was White Lightning.
Yeah. they knew you. They've read your books.
Right.
Well, it's just so delightful to talk to you. And I'm going to tell you right now, you have to come back on soon because there's so much to talk to you about. I want to go over more just suggestions that I'm sure that you can help, talk to the writers about, because I'm going to ask actually what happens after I get these programs, especially as I don't know, did I announce that you are a Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster? As I said, at the beginning, I can't list all of the awards you've won because it would take forever here. Just like when I spoke to Carolyn the other day, I got a lot of questions for her from my listeners. So I'm sure I'm going to get more from my listeners about you and about your books. And I hope that you'll come back on soon so that we can talk more. And also we can talk a little bit about Sigrid and where she came from and where that idea of her came from, because I think that's fascinating how you used your position, your job at the time, to come out with that character and with that idea.
That's another whole story.
It is. It's another whole story. And that's going to take another 30 or 40 minutes. And I want to have you back on for that. And I also want to find out about, you just had a little contest, didn't you?
Yes, for that short story.
Yes.
Well, the thing about it, have we got time for me to quickly?
Yeah, let's talk. That's what I wanted to talk about.
Okay. Several years ago, the group of writers that I'm most friendly with, tight with, we were talking about a colleague, an older colleague, who had stayed too long at the dance. And her last book had been much weaker than the earlier books that had made her career and had made her reputation. And we looked at each other and we said, look, if that ever happens to us, one of us must come and kill the other one so that we won't wreck our reputation that way. And so that was the pact that we made. And so that was what my short story is set at a mystery conference. And one of the five is murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And was it somebody else or was it one of the women? What? And that was the basis of the story. So my contest was read the story. And if you can figure out who the real-life counterparts of the fictional writers are, I will send you a copy of the magazine that has been autographed by those four women. And nobody won. I mean, there were a lot of guesses, but nobody came close.
Oh, why didn't I enter it? I think I would have won. I think I would have won. I really do. And that's in the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. And I'm so stupid. Why didn't I enter it? I would have won. I would have won. I know. I'm sure. Because.
Well, what I'm going to do with the magazine is when I go to Malice Domestic in the spring, I will donate it as an auction item for the charity.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. Well, I'm going to have to bid on that because I want that. Okay. Well, I want to thank you again for being on today and promise me you'll come back soon.
I promise.
Okay. I'll give you some open dates and I need you back on. There's just too much to talk to you about in a short time. I have another guest coming up after you and he is somebody from South Carolina.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's a fantastic, he's written a fantastic book and he was on the, it's called The President's Escort, and he escorted five presidents, Truman through Nixon, and the three alphabet presidents in between. And if people can, I don't know how many people out there know them anymore. Our education system's not that great, but we do have three presidents between Truman and Nixon. Yeah. So anybody who knows, put your thinking caps on. Anyway, his name is Joseph Browning Corbin, and I want to talk to him about his story. It's because it's really exciting that he has come out with this story, and
I bet it's fascinating. All the insights, and of course he couldn't tell everything.
No, we hope not.
Yeah.
But still,
well, Patsy, it has been a delight.
Well, yeah. You are a delight, and I mentioned to Carolyn that I was going to talk to you, and of course she's like, oh well. Oh, you're going to have a great time. And I said, I don't have enough time. And she said, you're right. And so, Carolyn, that was Carolyn's second visit to Joy on Paper. And so we're going to have you back soon, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Bye now.
Bye.
Okay. Great. We're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back with Joe Corbin.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side, on the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Joseph Browning Corbin, who is coming out with a new book. It's called The President's Escort. It's going to be coming out sometime around Thanksgiving, some maybe in December, but I wanted to have Joe on today so we can talk to him about his book, and I'm very happy that his wife, Nancy, has joined in, and we're going to talk about his adventures as an escort to five presidents. Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
It's still morning. We're still on the air. Yes. Okay. And hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
Okay, Nancy. Well, it's so nice to have both of you. As I said, Joe has just come out with this book, and it's called The President's Escort. And we want to talk a little bit about Joe's background. Nancy, can you tell us a little bit about Joe?
Well, Joe was actually born in Virginia. He's a Virginian. I'm from South Carolina. He grew up there and then went into the Army, was in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, served under General Patton, and then worked with General Eisenhower, and then came back to Washington and eventually went to work for the Washington with the Metropolitan Police Department, and from there, I guess he can take over.
Yeah. Then, Joe, how did you land up? You were there in the Metropolitan Police Department. How did you land up escorting presidents around?
Well, they assigned me up at the White House, and the people who go into the White House go in on the East Gate, and when they come out the Northeast Gate, and I was at the intersection of Madison, Pennsylvania Avenue, just to control traffic and pedestrians, and that's where I met President Truman. He would go for his walks, and he would always stop and chat with you, and you never knew what he was going to be talking about.
Okay, well, now, Joe escorted five presidents, from Truman to Nixon, and the three alphabet presidents in between were JFK, LBJ,
and Eisenhower.
Alphabet, but Ike was three letters.
Yeah. He followed
so,
Truman.
Exactly. So we had some really fun experiences in meeting these people.
Very much so.
And you started with Truman. Of course, you were very young, and I looked at the cover of your the upcoming book. It's got a handsome, hunky guy there in his uniform. So you were a really young guy when you first worked with Truman.
That I was.
And you liked him?
Oh, he was the greatest. He didn't have any sons, just the one daughter, Margaret. So I think that he, in his own mind, adopted me as his son.
Well, he could relate to you, I think, partly, of course. I'm sure he admired that you were in the Battle of the Bulge and that you had, this great military service behind you and had won, quite a few awards. And so I think it's just a wonderful compliment to Truman that he recognized somebody who was so nice.
Yep.
So you went on then to work with Ike. What did you find out in escorting Ike?
Well, when the war was over, him being the Supreme Allied Commander, he got to choose wherever he wanted. So he chose Wiesbaden as his headquarters, and we went down and set up his headquarters there for him, vacated about a 10-block square, and that's where all of us lived there in Wiesbaden up until I came home on an emergency furlough.
So when he got into the White House, were you were pleased to see him?
He didn't know me.
No, he had like only a couple million guys there that he had to know. It was not thing. But was he? What did you interact with him?
One of the few times he had anything to say to me, I escorted him over to the U.S. Capitol to lay the cornerstone for the north wing of the Capitol. It was, and they always do that on the 4th of July, right at high noon, and I got him over there 6-7 minutes before they were ready for him. Of course, he got out of the limo and came up and was standing and talking with me, and all at once he started perspiring, and he takes his finger and wipes it for him, and he says, "Awful hot out here, isn't it, officer?" I said, "It sure is, but it's that way all the time in Washington in July."
Oh, absolutely. It was a swamp, and maybe it still is a swamp, but it's definitely hot in July. Now, of course, Ike didn't, as you have mentioned, Ike did not like to go out to the airport to meet people, even world leaders when they arrived. So
the second time that Charles de Gaulle came here as president of France, I thought that he would probably want to go and meet him because he was winding down his 8 years in the White House. But no, he didn't. He sent Nixon, and we met de Gaulle at the airport and escorted him to the White House, and then he meets them and greets them officially there in the Rose Garden.
Now, de Gaulle was an impressive-looking person, huh?
You know, tall guy.
Tall and very impressive. So, yeah. Now, of course, Richard Nixon was the vice president at the time. And what kind of person was he?
Very nice to you. I had the president of Mexico coming in, Matos, and he was over at the Capitol for breakfast with the various leaders of the Senate, and so I went over there and met him, and he says, I got the president of Mexico coming in, and he's supposed to land at 8:30. Well, it was about 8:15 then, and we go down to Suitland Parkway, which is all park police territory, so I told the dispatcher to give him a couple park policemen to help with the escort. And when we got him over to Andrews, Matos was already landed and standing in the door of the plane waiting to be greeted, so I pulled his limo right up to the red carpet, and he got out, came over, and told us how happy he was that we had brought him over there on such a miserable morning, because it was sleeting and cold, and it was miserable. But that was terrible protocol to make the president of Mexico stand there waiting, but he came over and thanked us.
Well, it is. I know it's very emotional for you to go back to those years when you were serving the presidents. Now, Nancy, do you always find Joe's stories about the first ladies interesting?
Yes, they are, because the different first ladies were quite different. And so they are interesting, too. And I've gone through all these stories so many times that I've become pretty familiar with them.
So tell us what Joe says about Jackie Kennedy.
Jackie was quite a lady, besides being a very beautiful woman. But she was, she stood by Jack and was there when he needed her to be. And she liked to go out, as Joe has said, to watch the dogs, the police dogs being trained. And she liked to go see the horses. And so that's what she spent a lot of time with. And then when they had to go to official functions, Joe would take them, the two of them, to
balls. And she was always gracious, I understand. Everybody who I've spoken to, a few people who have been involved in writing books about that time period, and they always remark how very gracious.
She was very gracious.
And thoughtful. Yeah. And very thoughtful.
Very kind. A lot of times Jack would see a good-looking girl go by, and he'd nod and say, Joe. And, of course, I see the same thing that he sees, and he doesn't have to nudge me to notice. But even if Jackie was standing right there beside him, he didn't mind mentioning it to you. And I didn't like to say or do anything that would embarrass her in any way.
Well, you know, I just think we have to just always admire her so much for what the way she treated. You can tell so much about a person the way they treat the people around them, who do things for them, and if they're gracious, it says a lot about them. Mm-hmm. What about LBJ? Let's talk about LBJ.
The afternoon of the inauguration, I went up to the house there, and Mrs. Johnson says, I want to go over in Georgetown and get my hair done. That's where her favorite hairdresser was. And it was snowing, and at that time it was probably 4 or 5 inches of snow on the ground. And I said, okay, I'll escort you over. And Johnson sat down there at the table with a fistful of three feathers, which is a cheapest stuff you can get, really. And he took a big drink out of it. And so when we left, it was down maybe an inch or so. And we were there, oh, 2.5 hours. We got back, and it was only that much left in the bottom of it, maybe an inch and a half.
Okay. And it was what whiskey? Three Feathers?
Yeah.
Three Feathers. Okay. Well, I don't think I'm going to be drinking that.
No.
And, I'm going to interrupt.
And so this first ball. Excuse me.
Yeah.
This was at Kennedy's inauguration. Johnson was going in as vice president.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And Miss Johnson, so when we got back, she says, would you like to have dinner with us? And I said, sure. I have no other plans. I'm assigned to them for the whole duration. And so she asked the maid to set another place at the table. She didn't have to set another one because Johnson wasn't going to leave where he was drinking that whole right good whiskey he was drinking. But anyway, they bring out this huge container with a lid on it, and I'm thinking to myself, man, must be something good under that lid there. And you would never guess what it was.
Oh, no, what?
Hot dogs and beans.
Hot dogs and beans. Okay, well, there you are, sitting with the vice president, hot dogs and beans.
Yeah. So we, after that, I escorted him down to the Shoreham Hotel, which was his first ball. And by that time, the snow was about a foot deep, a little more, and it was difficult to get around. So when I got him there, he got out of the car, and he was having trouble standing up. And I guess people figured that it was because of the
ice.
Snow. And it wasn't that at all. But anyway, he looked at me and he said, I want you to go over in Georgetown and get my secretary. And I said, I'm not going over in Georgetown and get your secretary. Well, this discussion went on for a minute or so, and I looked around, and all the people that are going into ball have stopped to listen to what he and I are discussing. And Mrs. Johnson saw it about the same time. So she came over and got between he and I, and she said, turned to him, said, shut up. And apparently he thought that he was still talking to me. He turned on and said, what did you say? And she said it a little bit more emphatically. I said, shut up. And she turned to him and said, would you go over to Georgetown and get his secretary? I said, yes, Ms. Johnson, for you, I'll do it. So I went over and got him. And on the way back, I told the dispatcher to send somebody else up there to work with that drunk for the rest of the night, because I figured one of us may end up losing the job, and I knew it wouldn't be him.
Well, this is what you can look forward to when you read Joe's book. It's called The Joseph Browning Corbin Story, and it's The President's Escort. And there'll be a lot more stories in there, and I think it's just wonderful that you've written the book, because it's these type of things, these little details, that have to be remembered and have to be preserved, and they tell a more complete history of what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, if you've, whether, of course, you've done something as really exciting as Joe's story, but all of these memories and should be preserved, because you never know, you know, who they will help when somebody's doing some research into the time. And so I have a feeling that Joe's book again will be one that researchers will want to read, because it tells the full story. And I would want to say about Lady Bird, was she actually as tiny as she looks in the pictures?
Yes,
she's really tiny. Mm-hmm. And but she was also very nice, wasn't she?
I told Nancy, she's got a daughter that lives out in San Antonio. When we first got married, I said, she wanted to go out and visit. I said, only if I can go up and see Lady Bird and tell her how many times she saved my job.
Well, I, having lived in Texas for many, many years, I've always appreciated Lady Bird's work in preserving wildflowers, because to drive through Texas is sometimes in the springtime, it is the most amazing. You don't see it. I've never seen it in any other state. You're driving for miles and miles and miles. But because of Lady Bird, they've done these wildflowers on both sides of the highway.
Yes.
And it is absolutely magical.
It really is.
It is so beautiful. I mean, I don't know what it costs to do it, but I would recommend to a lot of states that it is something that it makes the journey so pleasant.
You almost forget
that you're, you know, on a drive, because you're just looking at these beautiful miles and miles of flowers. So I think that was one of a First Lady's projects. I think that has to be one of the most successful projects, and certainly a living testament to her interest. So anyway, I want to thank you both for being in the studio. I've invited you on when the book is actually released to come back, and we'll announce it again. But meanwhile, people can look in, I think, another few weeks. They will have it up on Amazon, and you can pre-order it. And it's always nice to pre-order. And it's, as I said, The President's Escort by Joseph B. Corbin. It'll be available, and you can pre-order it. And then I will have you back in, Joe and Nancy.
Thank you.
So we can talk about it. And I've also invited Joe and Nancy to appear at the Miami Avenue Book Nook in January, when we're going to have an author's event. And they will get to, Joe can put his book there to sell. And because we have at the Miami Avenue Book Nook, we showcase local authors, all the fantastic local authors that we have, like Angela Hunt, who did the novelization of Risen, the movie Risen, and of course, one of my very, very favorite mystery writers, Carol J. Perry, who has done the Witch City Mysteries, and it's coming up to Halloween, and everybody must read hers. And then we have Rita Moreau, who's going to be on my program pretty soon, sometime in November, to talk about her wonderful mystery series. So there's a lot of things to see at the Book Nook at Miami Avenue, which is located just two blocks south of the post office. So I hope that you'll pop in there. Meanwhile, I just want to tell everyone just have a great weekend. Next week, I have a lot of exciting things happening, and I will make some announcements. And meanwhile, just find your joy and share it and be kind to each other and read a book. And if not, start writing one, because you never know. It is November's coming up, and it is the November big deal to write a novel. So I'll talk more about that on Tuesday. Bye-bye for now.